these huge giants, you know, walking amidst the clouds or what have you.
Metal music. It's hard to write a song in an entire minor key and talk about, you know, nice things. Heavier, obviously, doomier at times.
When he came over, and God, when he started singing, bloody hell. I couldn't believe what's coming out of his little body.
Somebody said, anyone got an idea what we should do as a stage set? Jesus said, Stonehenge. So there's this dwarf who comes out, and he's walking across the top of the Stonehenge. Pure spank.
Black Shadow!
Hey, welcome back to Sabbath Bloody Podcast, a sabography for the masses. And it's been a while since I've said that. Feels good to be back. Happy New Year, everyone. Hope you're all keeping well out there. It's 2019, and fuck me, another decade nearly passing us by here. My God, the 20s are upon us. You know what? That's actually like the first one that actually sounds like a proper decade coming up since the 90s, right? Well, this season of Sabbath Bloody Podcast, I guess you can call these seasons, right? But it's going to be all about the 80s, dude. We're riding on here, protectors of the realm, into a new era of Sabbath. We'll call it Neon Sabbath. It's Heaven and Hell. That's the album we are covering today. It's not quite the band name yet, but maybe it should have been, right? Because the shift is pretty extreme here. This ain't your papa's Sabbath anymore, unless your papa's a wizard or some shit. Like a dungeon master. Because gone are the classic rock, doom, stoner vibes. The boys are getting full heavy metal here. Borderline power metal. Just, you know, chugging along, churning it out here. It's not really my thing. And that's why I needed to take that little break to purge from my comfortable fanboy Aussie era there. And give this post-Aussie era a proper listen. And listen to it in context, you know, because I don't want to just be on here with my inner stoner saying, it's not as good as Into the Void, man. Like, I'll suppress that low and slow demon there and give all this new stuff a fair shake. And you guys out there, you keep me honest too. If you catch me being too negative on all these post-Aussie runs, let me know. I'm discovering this all kind of for the first time, really. I mean, I've heard parts before. I know Neon Knights, I know the title track, Heaven and Hell. Like, those ones were really the only ones that I recalled from back in the day. Back in my day, anyway. I remember I had a friend in high school who kind of shoved those tracks down my throat when I said to him that I was like a big Sabbath fan, and then he said, oh yeah, how about Dio Sabbath? I'm like, I don't really know anything about Dio Sabbath. So he played Neon Knights for me, and I went, nah, it's not really for me. So then he skipped on to Heaven and Hell, and I was like, okay, yeah, that's kind of cool, I guess, but still, let's put on Volume 4, shall we? So, you know, all that jaded youth aside, today, I'm going in with open ears and an open heart. I'm really glad that I did a little dive into Dio's back catalog, too, some of the Rainbow stuff. I think it's prepared me for taking it in this time, for this epic onslaught of metal that we get here, so... You know, this stuff isn't as bad as I remembered it to be. Like, I'm on board this time. Still a little cheesy at points, but I really like the energy of the band. And Ronnie, I mean, he's a real shot in the arm. Pardon the expression to the drugged out hot mess that Sabbath had become with Ozzy there in the Never Say Die, Tech X eras. But okay, briefly now, to recap, Ozzy was fired from Black Sabbath in late April 1979. And it was because he'd become too unreliable for them. He was continuously wasted. And, you know, he'll be the first to admit it. And they had already, at the time, rented a house in L.A. and were actually starting working on this material that would become part of Heaven and Hell. Tony had enough of Ozzy kind of disappearing from the studio session and showing up too wasted to track anything. And just generally, he wasn't interested in the songs they were working on, or so the story goes. And it's not like the other lads were clean and sober here. Like, drugging was at a high for all four of them. And it would continue well into the production of this album and this tour. and well on into the 80s. It's just Ozzy's high, you know, well, it's fucking Ozzy Osbourne, so you can imagine it's a little beyond tolerable. Nibby actually was the one who was given the task to tell Ozzy to walk, which he did. And Sabbath was kind of left in a little bit of shambles. The Ardens, Don Arden and his daughter Sharon, they were still managing Black Sabbath, and they kind of saw this as an opportunity to break them into two bands. Black Sabbath, and then maybe Ozzy solo as well. That was the idea that Don suggested. He even suggested to Ozzy that he front a project called The Son of Sabbath. And of course, Don wasn't reading the room here, as these guys didn't want anything to do with each other at this time. Ozzy was quickly spiraling down into his epic bender, which deserves a podcast all to itself. And Tony wanted nothing to do with him. So essentially, making a long story short, Tony Iommi was looking to keep working on this batch of songs, but with a new singer. And Don Arden had his suggestions, but ultimately, it was Sharon Osbourne who introduced Iommi to Ronnie James Dio. And so here's a quote from Tony's book. I have to say, a lot of the material I have, the research material, the literature, it kind of cuts off when Dio comes into the band. And that's just the way things are. I mean, the Ozzy era is the classic Sabbath, and that's what they've curated to be what Black Sabbath is at this point. But Tony's book, of course, it carries through all this. So here he is speaking on the meeting of the two Italian stallions here. Sharon introduced me to Ronnie James Dio at a party. She suggested I should do a separate project and do that with Ronnie. I approached him and said, I'm in a terrible situation. I don't think it's going to work out anymore with what we got. Would you be interested in doing something? Ronnie was up for doing something together, but I didn't get in touch with him for a while because we were still in a state of confusion about Ozzy. After he left, I finally said to Bill and Geezer, why don't we try Ronnie? I called him up and I said, we're having another type of situation. Would you be interested in having a go? We invited him over to the house and played him Children of the Sea. Just like that, Ronnie came up with this vocal melody for it. We were really impressed because within a day, we'd gone from nothing happening for ages to being able to come up with a song immediately. We played a bit of Lady Evil, and Ronnie immediately sang to that as well. We thought, bloody hell, we're on to a winner. So there you go, and you can decide for yourself how much you think Sharon was involved there and them meeting. People are quick to shit on her, I know, but I totally believe that she would have had the foresight to pair those two together. Y'all should know, I love Sharon, and I think she's a badass, and this is a great combination. Tony Iommi, Ronnie James Dio, come on. So here's some more from Tony about their working relationship here. He says, we went with Ronnie because we liked the way that he worked and we liked his voice. The music took a different turn after he joined us. For Heaven and Hell, we were writing for a singer who was so different that it opened up more doors. When you work with Ozzy for 10 years, you know roughly what he's going to sing and how he's going to do that. You're familiar with his capabilities. We didn't know what Ronnie's capabilities were, and it was a matter of pushing all the time to see what he could do. It was new blood in the band. I could play different chords. It gave me other places to go music-wise, and Ronnie really encouraged me to play solos, to break out a little bit more. So yeah, there you go. Ronnie becomes kind of a muse for Tony's new style here. And with this working, he kind of suggested that they just rebuild Black Sabbath together with Ronnie. And Ronnie, of course, was a little weary over stepping into Ozzy's place. He was thinking maybe another project altogether would be a better way to do it. But Tony assured him that Ronnie would still co-front the group musically and in every other way. And so with Don Arden getting wind of this Dio operation, he didn't dig it at all. He disowned this incarnation altogether. So they had to kind of rebuild a creative and management team. So they dipped into Ronnie's rainbow Rolodex there, and they signed on with manager Sandy Perlman, who also managed Blue Oyster Cult. He was kind of a mutual acquaintance of Iommi and Dio. And they also got producer Martin Birch on board, and he was going to record these songs proper once they got them together. And Ronnie had worked extensively with him in Rainbow. And I think even he did some Elf albums with him, like, way back in the day. So there's some history there. Dio was bringing in his crew. And things were moving around here. And at this time, one of the OGs, he kind of distanced himself from the group. And that was Geezer. So he had some kind of personal issues going on. I think he was going through a divorce or something like that. So it was Tony and Ronnie driving the creative engine for this new Sabbath. And they had a couple of other creative partners that they brought in to fill in the void of Geezer. So let's get into the studio cats here, the session guys that were involved. Of course, Bill Ward, still on board. Gotta mention that. Nibby is behind the kit. He's in a little bit of a rough place. He's hitting the drink pretty hard. They were all still partying pretty hard, like I said, but Nibby in particular was rough stuff around this era. So he doesn't recall much of it in interviews, but he was there. But let's talk about, like I said, these kind of session guys that came in here. And the first one, it's not really a session guy. This guy kind of becomes the next member, the hidden member of Black Sabbath for quite some time. Enter Jeffrey James Nichols. So Jeff, he's definitely the most important part here. He's a multi-instrumentalist, and Tony brought him in so he could kind of like call on him at any time and flesh out his riffs into proper compositions to show to singers, in this case Dio by this point. But he kind of became like Tony's partner in crime. He's the perfect guy to bring it all together for Tony and let Tony drive his vision forward. Still working on these songs. Like I said, very versatile musician, playing keyboards primarily, but also filling in on second guitar and bass. And Tony was very comfortable working with Jeff Nichols. And in fact, he has some creative history with him earlier in the late 70s. I didn't mention this in the Never Say Die episode. I probably should have. But around like 77, when things with Ozzy were looking a little bleak, Tony took some time off away from the Sabbath, and he acted as a producer on an album. He hooked up with Jeff Nichols' first band, which was called Quartz, and he did their debut album there. So, yeah, Jeff is a homie here, and he mixes in well with Bill and Tony and Ronnie. And actually, the first song that these four come up with turned out to be Heaven and Hell, known by the working title of On and On at the time. But there's a leaked demo out there of the Heaven and Hell demo with Jeff playing bass. So you can kind of get that feel for what they were sounding like after Geezer departed and they still pressed on. And although they were able to be creative with Jeff in the fold, and they were clicking at this point, Ronnie suggested that they bring in an old writing partner of his from Rainbow to play bass. And that was Craig Gruber. And this is an interesting story here. And I have a bit here from Tony in his book on Craig's role, which I'll read first. But I also found another article where Craig was interviewed in detail about his collaboration with Sabbath. And it's got a different kind of slant on things. So I find it interesting. Like all the stuff, the studio lore about songs, especially, you know, ones that are like created in the studio. So bear with me as I go through a couple of articles here. I'm going to be reading out loud. But we'll go to Tony's words here first. We shipped out to Miami. We did the same as we did in LA. We created a rehearsal space where we set up all the gear. We had Craig Gruber come in, a bass player who used to be in Rainbow with Ronnie. We kept Jeff on too because we got on so well with him that we tried him out on keyboards. He was fairly new to it, but he was good enough for what we wanted. Play the chords and come up with some ideas as far as to what plays behind the chords. We wrote more stuff without Geezer this time. It was awkward for me and Bill because we were so used to working with him. Everything felt like it was on a temporary basis because we were still hoping that Geezer would come back. It was hard, but we carried on. Writing actually went smoothly, and we soon finished an album's worth of songs. And so here we go. Let's bring in another view of this so we can unpack it. And this is kind of a controversial thing here. The bass tracks that end up on the album. Whose are they? Who wrote them? Apparently, or at least the Sabbath camp, claims that upon Geezer's eventual return, they retract everything from scratch bass-wise, but Gruber had been quoted as saying that it was still his bass on the album, and he was kind of arguing that fact. But a lot of the bass tracks are very sterile on here, actually. They don't actually sound like a Geezer bass line to me. Like, it doesn't move like Geezer's bass does in the 70s offerings. There's no attack, even, that you definitely hear when he's back in the fold for, like, Mob Rules and stuff. It's a little tricky to prove whether it's his part or not, too, because, like, you know, sometimes this happens with session bassists not wanting to keep them in on the royalties. But I found a few articles regarding the situation, and this one here in particular, this is from the horse's mouth, so to speak. So, an interview with Craig Gruber from a blog. Remember blogs? Do people still blog? A blog called Stone Cold Crazy Yo from 2009. And honestly, MacGruber, we'll call him MacGruber, he does sound a little butthurt about the whole deal. So take this with a grain of salt. Let's just comb through it, get his side of things. You decide what you want to believe, Supernauts. Also, Gruber died in 2015 too. So this is the only interview that I could find of him speaking directly about his time with Sabbath. Now, here we go. Ronnie calls me up. He says, "Listen, before you hang up, I know you're pissed, but hear me out." It's a great way to start a call, right? I said, "The only reason you're calling me, Ronnie, is because you fucking want something. You never call anybody if it's gonna do him any good. You're one of those, so fuck you." And I hung up. Ronnie calls back again and he says, "Listen, I just joined Black Sabbath." And I laughed right out loud. Then I remember saying, "Those fucking dinosaurs." That's a terrible thing to say, but they were done at that time. Never Say Die was the last album, and it was horrible. Hey, whoa. Craig, pump the brakes, buddy. Fuck you. Never Say Die was the shit. Junior's eyes, Shockwave, come on. But I digress. But you can see, like, Craig is kind of driving at here. He's not painting a loving picture of his relationship with this Sabbath camp here in order to make himself kind of look more badass, I think. But let's read on now. So they came and got me, and we drove up to this 5-car garage in a gorgeous house. And I said, "Ah, looks like you guys got some money. That's a good sign." Ronnie and I walk up to the door. Bill Ward opens the door. It's about 6 at night. All he's got on are his boxer shorts, and he's got a 16-ounce can of Schlitz in his hand. He hasn't shaven for like 5 days. I didn't know who he was because he didn't look like any of the pictures. He looked like a garage guy that fixes cars. He said, "Come in, mates. I'll take you to the living room and you can meet Tony and the rest of us and we'll have a little chat." Ronnie goes, "Bill, this is Craig." And I went, "Okay, it's a pleasure to meet you in your underwear." We'll get to Nibby State more and more as this comes through. It's not good times, but it's kind of funny, right? Like, getting a jaded look into the making of Dio Sabbath here. I kind of love that. I've heard other stories that match up with this scene too, so I don't think it's total bullshit or exaggerations. Like, Mick Wall talks about how bad Nibby was at the time making this album when he was doing PR for Sabbath and he visited him and he said he was in this kind of state. So anyway, but Craig continues, "We walked into the living room and there's Tony, because I recognized the really thick squared off helmet hair that he had back then. He's standing there and he's got a couple of Marshall cabinets in the middle of the living room cranking metal." So I just sat and chatted a little bit, and then Bill got behind the drums. There's a drum kit right in the living room, and the drum leg, you know, the little legs, they're digging into this beautiful floor. They didn't give a shit. There were beer cans and shit all over the floor in this house. They went into Children of the Sea. So he goes, "See if you can follow this. It's in A, Craig." So I dropped in, no problem. Then they showed me Wishing Well. And I can't remember the third song. But anyway, we played there for about an hour or two. And I mean, just kind of jammed in this house. And Ronnie said, "What's it feel like to you?" And I said, "I don't know. Doesn't feel like anything." He goes, "Well, think about it. I'm going to talk to these guys for a couple of days and we'll call you back." So they took me back to my house And a couple days later, Ronnie rings me back and he says, "We rented Sears Studios in Hollywood. We got a full setup there and we'd like you to come back in and play for a day and see what happens." So that's how the Sabbath thing started. Okay, so Craig does some tracking with them then. That's confirmed. And your man here, whoever was interviewing him, asks him how involved he was in that writing process. So he says, "Tony said, I need something that's a cruncher. Something that's up-tempo. Something that's going to change the tempo of this album. Do you have anything? I had a song called Blinder, and it was kind of like a Kill the King sort of song. It was really fast, and I ended up using it with Gary Moore. I also had this idea called Die Young." Ronnie says, "What's that about?" I said, "Well, it's self-explanatory. My idea in life is to get in, get what you want, get out quick." He goes, "Okay, cool. Let's see what you got." So I played the riff. It was in the key of E, so it was easy to drop in on. And then we worked that up. In about an hour, we had Die Young done. So that's cool. One of my favorites from the album, actually, I will interject here. And it does kind of stand out as a different kind of vibe from the rest of the album. There's very cool dynamics in it. A standout, really. So, I mean, if that's all that Craig contributed, that's fucking top notch for me. But let's wrap up his little epic here, the MacGruber epic here. He speaks about the return of my man, Geezer Butler here. "We were making plans for rehearsals and the date that the album was going to come out. Ronnie said, 'We've had a band meeting, Craig, and there's something we need to discuss with you.' I said, 'Okay, no problem.' Ronnie said, 'Geezer has been in contact with the band. Of course, he's been in the band for 15 years. While you were gone, him and Tony were on the phone together, and we actually sent him a copy of what we had done. He's very interested. He really, really is excited about the band again, and he loves what we've done. We're trying to make this transition equitable for everyone, and we really think it would be better if Geezer came back into the band. How do you feel about that?' he said. I said, 'Well, musically, I think it's probably the smartest thing you could do, because he is an original member. Really, what I did was kind of just filled in his shoes. I never expected to be the bassist in this band. I didn't come in here to replace Geezer. You can't replace the guy.' So there you go." Well said, Craig. And yeah, that gets us back. I hope you all enjoyed that little switchback, but we're on track again. The three OGs, Tony, Geezer, and Bill, and the two new kids on the block, Ronnie James Dio and Jeff Nicholas. It's heaven and hell. So, the mix for the album is done in Paris once they get all the tracks together, as well as retracking Geezer's bass over Gruber's work. That's not confirmed if that happened or didn't happen. There's all kinds of, controversy still there, but I think it's Geezer's tracks, but maybe he didn't deviate from the template very much, if you know what I'm saying. And they also came up with a new one too, which became the eventual opener of the album, Neon Nights, the last song to be completed. I think they even did that in Paris during those last days mixing. So let's have a look at some of the songs on this album.
"Far the Rift Compels Me.
Won't you listen?
To the Leather Clad Years. So the Power of the Rift today. Ronnie James Dio just getting medieval on your ass right out of the gate with this one, Neon Nights. Neon Nights was actually the last track that they wrote and recorded in these sessions, so it does have a kind of a different vibe to it, energy-wise. In that context, it kind of shows what they arrived at, where their lineup got to after all the rehearsing and recording. But shit, man, look out. There's a great acoustic interlude. Children of the Sea, one of my favorites from the album. There's a brilliant build-up on this one. I urge you to just go listen to this track, get the full effect of it, because it is really about the whole band. Even the keys on this are fucking amazing. And still, as incredible as this is, it's still only the second best Sabbath track with Children in its title, right? I'm just saying. See, I've already shat on my promise to not compare this stuff to Ozzy. And unfortunately, I can't play Ronnie's vocal track here because that's the true power of this track. I think Dio really invigorates Tony's style. These long epics. There's much more space in his riffs. And Dio actually does something with that space, you know, where Ozzy would have just said, "Oh, Lord, yeah," and then let Tony figure out where he was going. But Dio gets operatic. He brings new melodies out in the riff and sings over parts that the Oz man wouldn't dare touch. This was actually one of the first tracks that the lads all worked on together. And there's no doubt that there's some real fucking magic here, Dio and Iommi. So I could only imagine how excited they were when Dio just started belting over the tracks that they had come up with. It should be mentioned, even though I'm not playing the vocal tracks here, Geezer was no longer given the task of writing lyrics. Ronnie likes to write for himself, and Ronnie's lyrics are very, well, very Dio. Like the next track on Heaven and Hell, Lady Evil, Evil! The main thing I notice on this one is there isn't really that great lyrical content anymore. Like, all the lyrics on Heaven and Hell are Ronnie James Dio, like I said. And he's a little hit and miss for me. Not in delivery, of course. He's a fucking phenomenal singer. But in content, there's nothing that I can really grab onto there. Like, Lady Evil is kind of cheese. But a lot of people dig it. And you know what? It is. It's a fucking grower. I mean, the first listen through, I thought it was very weak. But having heard a bunch of live cuts of it, actually, coming around to it, I will say, there's an edited version of the song too that still lags in my opinion. They just took a little bit off the intro. It's a bad edit too when you're used to the real version. But here are the lyrics. We've got to show the flavor that Dio brings here. There's a place just south of Witch's Valley where they say the wind won't blow and they only speak in whispers of her name. There's a lady, they say, who feeds the darkness and eats right from her hand. With a crying shout, she'll search you out and freeze you where you stand. So, gone are the dirty women. The new ladies of the Sabbath are full-on fucking witches, son. Witches Valley, I guess that's kind of cool, right? Hell, maybe I'll come around to these tracks, but I'm not big on the guts of the LP, really. And not because I'm hung up on Ozzy. No, it's actually because I jumped ahead to the next Dio-fronted album very quickly, and I absolutely fell in love with Mob Rules. So this just feels like the beginnings here in that context. Ronnie, he feels kind of timid to me on this album. However, Tony's licks are pretty fucking hot, right? Ben's riffing this one here. Yeah, and I love the transition out of the first solo. But Tony is laying lead all over this track, all over this fucking album. So let's just keep on and on. And on, because you know what's next? It's motherfucking Heaven and Hell. Yeah, we all know this one. Probably one of the most iconic Sabbath songs of all time. A staple in heavy metal karaoke. I don't know if it's just kind of overplayed to me, but I find that it kind of drags like all hell when I listen to it now. But hey, it's a great track, but I've heard people say that it's like the best track of all time, the whole Dio era, and I wouldn't say that. Let's burn through the last four songs on the album here. First of all, we get a bit of a break from the badass of Heaven and Hell. This is a rather forgettable number that follows up called Wishing Well, closing out the A-side. Does anybody dig this track? Let me know what you catch in it if you do. It's just there's nothing for me in the Wishing Well. On to the next one, though. The Craig Gruber original here, as I found out in my readings. Die Young. Showcases Tony's ability to change and play Dio's voice, but the rhythm section does not step it up. It's like
Love what Bill Ward brings to the table. He is part of what Sabbath is. Super creative cat when he's on his game. But by this point, the booze was really catching up to him, you can tell. And by all accounts, he was pretty much non-present during this album. Actually, the next track on the album is one of the most generic rock drumming in history. Walk Away. The riff's cool though. Ben can play that for us. This one just sounds like they're doing a Kiss song, like, lick it up. But the final track of the album, another fucking redeemer, especially for Nibby, because Nibby fucking kills it. Onto Lonely Is the Word. The album's fantastic closer. Yeah, man, you gotta go listen to the actual track on this one, because Bill's drums are catching all kinds of magic behind there with an off-time kind of kick, hi-hat deal. I love this track. Killer closer. One of the highlights of the album. The chorus is short, but it's kind of cool too. And I love Dio's swagger on here. He goes into these, yeah, yeah, yeahs for like the pre-chorus. It's like a taste of what's to come, I find. The track's just kind of composed in this unique way, you know? Like he builds off of the chorus and the prelude. Yeah, just go listen to it. As much as I kind of slayed the middle of this album here, this and Children of the Sea are the big redeemers on this album. And Heaven and Hell is a fucking good record.
Far the rift compels me.
All right now.
With Sandy Pearlman as their new manager, setting the dates for a big-ass tour that would be kicking off in 1980, they would ultimately be joining forces with another act who they could kind of co-headline with and was under the management of Sandy Pearlman as well, and that was BOC, Blue Oyster Cult. Who are kind of like Sabbath worshippers in their own right, but big band at the time, Don't Fear the Reaper. So let's get on that lovely caravan and ride out, protectors all around.
It is a funny story. I think those stories are kind of best in the caravan.
A co-headlining tour here where Sabbath would close out one night and BOC would close out the other. Equal opportunity rockin'. And after a few random U.S. warm-up gigs, the official Black and Blue tour started in July of 1980. It kicked off in Houston, Texas, I believe, on the 13th. BOC, they had like this big fiberglass dragon thing on the stage. It took them forever to set up. Ronnie must have saw that and thought, shit, I can use that for my solo career. This Sabbath thing goes tits up. And it was, you know, kind of seeming like it was a month or so into the tour. By August of 1980, the 21st to be exact, before a gig in Denver, Bill Ward apparently got absolutely legless, as they say, and instead of going into the gig, he climbed into his VW tour bus that him and his brother would drive around for the tour because he didn't like to fly, and they just fucking disappeared. Tony says he never even said goodbye. They had to cancel a bunch of gigs. And, you know, he was gone. Just dust in the wind. Lonely is the word. And then there were two. So, only two original members left now. And Tony officially becomes the longest-serving Sabbath member once Bill takes this hiatus here. But we'll reconnect with Nibby in a couple of episodes, don't you worry. But pressing on here with Heaven and Hell in this cycle, let's meet his replacement, the newest member of Black Sabbath, Mr. Vinny Appice, or Appice. I don't really know how you say it. But another Italian over here, well, he's actually American, but an Italian-American. And this is the lineup that Ozzy actually affectionately referred to as Geezer and the Italians. So, Tony Boy, Little Ronnie, Big Vinny, and Terrence Butler as the Geezer. Gotta leave it to Geezer. So, here's some more on Vinny Appice from Tony's book. And Vinny is a big change from Nibby, but he's fucking badass. Tony sums it up perfectly here. They're very different drummers indeed, so there's quite a difference between the way Vinny and Bill play drums. Vinny came in with all these fast rolls,
which Bill didn't play at all. Bill was from the John Bonham, Cozy Powell kind of camp. He was good, he had his own style, he created very unique things, very unorthodox. Bill wouldn't play a straightforward beat, he would always put some little bits in, like a percussionist. He would hear these symphonies in his head and he would try to play like he had eight hands. We'd say, Bill, you know you only got two arms. But that was Bill. He'd listen to the songs and see all this dynamic stuff in them. Timpanis and all that. So he'd think more percussion-wise. Vinny is just an out-and-out drummer. He'll play a beat forever. And he'll do these odd little rolls. But Vinny is a real precise drummer, whereas Bill, it was touch and go. Bill would do things and sometimes they would come off and sometimes they wouldn't. Vinny's drumming brought something else to the music. It made it tighter, made it more precise, and probably even more mainstream.
You fucking sold out, man. No Bill Ward, no Sabbath.
I can hear you guys now. And, you know, normally I think I'd be with you. Fucking Nibby's my man. And it wasn't until recently, though, when I listened to this stuff, and I listened to Mob Rules in particular. I did jump ahead and listen to that album for the first time, but Apathy's fucking great. And like Ronnie, he was another shot in the arm for Sabbath here amidst a big coming out tour that they were doing here. To be honest, I think Bill lost a lot of his confidence when Ozzy split, and he never fully recovered from that. I mean, don't get me wrong, stellar drumming all over the Heaven and Hell project, but he doesn't blow me away anywhere except the very last track. You know, in comparison to how amazing he is on the Ozzy era stuff. Like, I love his drumming on Never Say Die. I love his drumming in Tech X. Fuck, man. And the other album's untouchable, right? But Vinny's a better fit for this sound. So I'm not going to say no Bill Ward, no Sabbath. I'm going to say no Dio without Vinny Appice. The guy's a machine. And so Dio Sabbath live, it was a great show. Selling out everywhere. And there's a great document of this big black and blue tour that exists too. We're all very lucky to have a full concert film out of this. Well, albeit a kind of edited down version of their set list and jumbled around, but it's a fucking great video of Dio Sabbath in action if you want to check that out. I'll admit, it's a little Dio focused in the edit. The camera seems to be drawn to him, so if you want an hour of Dio flashing the devil horns and working the mic stand, this concert is your mainline fix. But it's great. I got one last treat here. I know we should probably wrap this up already. I just can't, man. I go on and on and on. And this here, I could save it for the next episode because it really ties into the next album, but it was released earlier than that, so a standalone offering, you could call it, for a soundtrack here. The first Black Sabbath soundtrack appearance. Let's get into this. We got some backstory here. So while on tour, the band was contacted by the production of an animated adult-themed fantasy movie called Heavy Metal. Now, I remember this movie. They would play it all the time on like late-night Canadian cable TV because it was a Canadian production, I think. I know John Candy and some of the SCTV guys were involved in it, but it's based on the Heavy Metal adult fantasy magazine that was big in like the 70s and 80s. And I even had a couple of them when I was a young boy. I snuck a couple in. It was all drawings of like big-breasted warrior women. Tons of violence and great sci-fi dystopian stuff. But the Sabs connection here, though, in the late 1980, they were contacted to see if they could record a song for the soundtrack of this Heavy Metal movie, animated movie. And not only provide a song, but actually kind of score a scene. So they went to Tettenhurst Park Studio. Interestingly enough, Tettenhurst Park, that may ring a bell for any Beatle maniacs out there, or Lennon fans. That's the studio in John Lennon's former house that was, at this point, rented to Sabbath by Ringo Starr himself, as John had been assassinated by then, and left it to the drummer, I believe. Or maybe he just sold it to Ringo before he was assassinated, I don't know.
They wrote and recorded the first versions of the tracks E5150, which is an instrumental, and Mob Rules, which would become the title track of the next album that we will discuss next month or next week, whenever I do it. So E5150, or E5150, if you're a Van Halen fan, it's an instrumental track not included on the soundtrack record itself, but is heard in the film score. So people often overlook that it was conceived and recorded at this time. The band, they got an amazing raw, like natural sound for this recording of Mob Rules in particular, using the vintage equipment of the studio. And apparently Martin Birch, he didn't actually care for these recordings, but I love them, and so did the lads. That version of Mob Rules is awesome. I'm probably going to just close out the episode by playing a clip from it, just so you get a taste. But here, I'll even play a little E5150 for you, too, here as I read this out. This is from Tony's book, of course. So he says, "The room we recorded in was the white room that you always see in those old films about John and Yoko. They had a little studio in the back part of the house, and we just used their gear. We set up Vinny in the hallway, and I had my amp in the studio. We used Lennon's engineer as well, so we heard all these stories. It was quite a nice few days. It was a great atmosphere, and we got some good vibes from there. Heavy Metal was an animated film. They asked us to write a song for its soundtrack, but the movie wasn't finished yet, so they just sent us some black and white sketches of it and the storyboard. It was difficult to write for that, as you don't have any idea of the timing of the scene. They just told us the length of the music they needed for the bit, and I suppose they animated more around what we came up with. We did an intro with this scene of these people before they turned into monsters. So we made all these effects, bubbling sounds and bass sounds and God knows what else. And then we went into the track, The Mob Rules. We recorded it right there and sent it off to the movie people who put it on the soundtrack as it was. So here it is, Mob Rules from the Heavy Metal soundtrack. This doesn't leave you stoked for the next installment of Sabbath Buddy Podcast. Well, you're a damn fool. Hey, so thanks for tuning back in here to the feed here. And I promise the next one won't take several months like this one did. It's coming quick. And in the meantime, hit me up on Twitter at SabbathBuddyPC or email SabbathBuddyPodcast@gmail.com. Let's talk some Dio, folks. All right, till next time. Bog blast all of ya. Kill the spirit and you'll be behind me.